The Doctor Is In is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
You want the good news, you want the bad news?
I don't like either one of those options.
Your words are super wise, man.
You are a prophet. You deserve a prophet.
You do whatever you want. Who am I to tell you what to do?
But you're a psychologist.
Well, I know less than you do.
You're making me a better parent and a better wife, and thank God you're on the radio.
What planet are you on? I don't buy any of that stuff.
You know, I was looking for a deeper answer.
What are you talking about?
You make my afternoon really fun. Enjoy ya.
You're about the most exciting thing I have right now.
Now, from the studios of Living Bread Radio Network in Canton, Ohio, the hometown of Mother Angelica, here's Dr. Ray.
That's like that comedian said. He said he did a down south, and lady came up to him and said, "I'm Georgia." He said, "You're in Georgia." "No! I'm Georgia. My mother in Georgia." "Your mother's in Georgia." "No." Good to have you with me. I'm Dr. Ray Grandy, program Doctor Is In. Monday through Friday, 1 o'clock Eastern Time. I used to say Eastern Standard Time until I was corrected by an e-person who wrote in and said, they don't do that anymore. Not only can I not keep up with vocabulary, I can't even keep up with the letters. So I guess it's Eastern time, 1 o'clock, Monday through Friday. I got to see. I shouldn't have done this. This is why I don't post. Somebody posted that they had just made synonym buns. You know, S-Y-N-O-N-Y-M, synonym buns. So I replied, "You mean just like the ones that Grammar used to make?" I'm blocked now. good to have you. This is E-Person. But as all variants... Oh, can't use that word anymore, can you? All variants of the Doctor Is In. By the way, viruses do variant. I mean, that's what they do. That is the very core. Every virologist will tell you that. They vary. And interestingly enough, basic virology says, and again, I don't want to digress too far on this, but we just really got to get some semblance of stability back in this. Basic virology says that immune response of a person to a virus in many ways can make them immune to similar variants of the virus. And this virus, supposedly, at least according to what's being pushed upon us, is different than any other virus that ever existed. I exaggerate, but there's a lot of truth in that statement. All right, that's enough of that. I don't want to get too far into that. Letter overload. That is the term I have given to what is epidemic, to use a word, among raising children today, among the analyzing and assessment of children. Here's how letter overload works. Take your basic child, and for whatever the reason, do not love this child, or do not give this child stability from malignant neglect all the way to permissive, spoiled, rotten, self-centered indulgence. On a 1 to 10 scale, some children need a 2 to be raised well. And some children need an 8 to be raised well. So for whatever the reason, if the parent is not at least striving to do what he or she needs to do, I hate when I have to say that, he or she. That just bugs me. Can I say he? Can I say she? And then if I say she, it makes it sound like I'm blaming mothers. And if I say he, it makes it sound like I'm insensitive to half the population. How do we get to this point? If the parent doesn't do what they need to do to raise this child as best they can with morals and virtue and stability and maturity and trustworthiness. The child, over time, can look, well, I don't want to use the word, but I will, disordered. Aggressive types of conduct, belligerent types of conduct, in-your-face kinds of conduct, oppositional, defiant, sometimes conscienceless-looking sort of conduct. And then, in the course of things, very often, an expert of some type comes along and, at the behest of the school or the parents or someone, the GP, says, I will assess this child, and I have determined the child is a bit disordered. The child has letters. The child has ODD, ADD, ADHD, LSMFT, IRS, EIEIO. Child has letters. ODD, oppositional defiant disorder. It's the number one disorder pretty much tagged on younger kids. It's not really a disorder. It's a summary label for a lot of bad behavior. In somebody's judgment, this child's behavior is too rule-resistant, too oppositional over a period of time that we're going to call it a disorder. I mean, that's how you do it. You can't measure it. That's how you do it. Oh, yeah, you can measure it if you have like a little survey kind of categorical sort of yes, no's, how much, 1 to 5. ADD, ADHD. Yeah, probably the best way to look at those two etiologically different problems is that they are the tail end of the normal temperamental continuum. It is my contention, it is my experience, and now research is coming out to back this up, that these letters are pouring down on our children in obscene quantities. Now, why is this so? Well, in part, because if we big people don't do what we need to do to socialize and moralize this child and to give this child some kind of discipline and self-control, the child can look very bad. And then, as he looks bad in his conduct or his attitude or his demeanor, we look at him and we say, what's wrong with you? Why are you like this? Why are you so aggressive? Why are you so selfish? Why are you so immature about these things? Why are you so defiant? Why are you so oppositional? We look at the child and we say there's something deficient in this child's makeup, in his personality, in his temperament, in who he is. Something's wrong in there. You know, that has bothered me so much as a psychologist, as I've been in this business for 40 plus years. It really has. And I will tell you why. My own personal experience is when I deal with parents, much of the time, they'll come in with a child who's already been diagnosed in some type of behavioral diagnosis by somewhere, somebody, whether it's their general practitioner or some other counselor. And they'll come in and they'll ask for parenting help. And typically, there's a lot of things these folks can do to dramatically improve their parenting and their discipline. Dramatically so. And if we work together and they cooperate, the child does get better. The behavior changes. I've had so many parents say to me, I feel like I'm living with a different child. I don't know who this child is. He's completely a different person. And I'll say, well, if that's the case, how is it that you were so convinced that there was something wrong with him? What happened to the wrongness? Where'd it go? And then I ask, well, do you think that the diagnosis still apply? Well, if they do, it's not as much, nowhere near as much. Right. Because so much can be explained by the dynamic between the parents and the kid. If you got a kid that's a behavior problem, you can't control him. Well, the sky's the limit. He's going to do what he wants to push on you. He's going to do what he wants to challenge you. He's going to do what he wants to argue with you, defy you, sneak around you. Those things are going to happen. He's a kid. That's what they do. And if we as parents don't have confident enough action-oriented, not mouth-oriented, discipline, then he's going to start with time looking worse and worse. And then the search begins. What is wrong with him? Why is he like this? You know, I've heard about that diagnosis. Maybe that's what he is. Maybe that's what he has. I always love that. He has that. He has oppositional defiant disorder. Like it's something that infected him. Oh, I think letter overload's a huge problem now. Huge. I'm not saying that there aren't kids who can be incredibly difficult or who can have attention or impulse problems. I'm not denying that. I'm just saying that the view of how many of them there are has truly been exploding. And it is parallel to the fact that as parents have more and more lost their authority, as the culture has worked so hard against them, as technology has tried to shape who their kid is, the kids aren't socializing smoothly. And when that happens, you search for an explanation. And typically, we don't begin our search by looking at ourselves. We begin our search by looking at the child. And that may be the wrong place to begin. I'm Dr. Ray.
Yesterday, you said tomorrow. So just do it! Make your dreams come true!
The doctor will be with you in just a moment.
Solidarity HealthShare began out of the Christian tradition of neighbor helping neighbor. They're a nonprofit medical cost-sharing ministry in which their members share in each other's eligible medical expenses. Solidarity HealthShare is not insurance, but rather an alternative way to pay for medical costs that adheres to the teachings of the Catholic Church. They'll never share in a medical care that goes against their values and morals, such as abortion, contraception, and sterilization. More information available at SolidarityHealthShare.org or at 844-313-4999.
Father Benedict Groeschel.
In the church, we speak of seven gifts: wisdom, understanding, counsel, knowledge, loyalty, courage, and reverence or fear of the Lord. When I speak about the gifts of the Holy Spirit, and these gifts come, they give you the ability to go beyond your strength. If you're struggling to be a good person, a good member of your religion, you know it's a struggle and you don't always make it. I've been at it many, many decades and I still struggle and trip and fall and have holes in my socks. Struggling to be a good person, something that we need help at. And this help comes to us by these gifts of the Holy Spirit.
EWTN. Live truth. Live Catholic.
Would you get on a plane that doesn't have a pilot? Investing in passive index mutual funds may present the same issue. The Ave Maria mutual funds are actively managed by seasoned investment professionals to help you meet your investment goals in a morally responsible way. Ave Maria funds are managed to conform to pro-life and pro-family values. Long-term investors could invest in the no-load Ave Maria mutual funds. You can learn more about the Ave Maria Mutual Funds at 866-AVE-MARIA or visit AveMariaFunds.com.
I was going to say good to see you, but it's not really it. Radio. I was going to say good to hear from you. That's not really it either. I guess the most accurate thing I can say is good to read from you, because this is E-Person Monday, where I go into your emails and I get as many emails as we do calls about situations. I very much enjoy reading the emails. I read all of them. Some of them are very long, very, very long, which means they can't be used on the air. You can't get a 900-word email. I feel bad because obviously somebody sat down to write all that. And at the end, they usually say, advice, please. And much of the time, I'll say, here's a very complex situation. I can't give you thoughts on something that complex. If you can call in, maybe I can ask a few questions. But most of the e-persons are usable on the air because they're a certain length. And I enjoy reading them and attempting to hear, read what the person is saying in between the lines. I don't want to follow a pattern of, I'll read the E person, and at the end, I'll say, okay, here's what I think. I don't like doing that. Because in any kind of counseling, when somebody talks to you, one of the things that makes counseling tough is you got to be hyper-vigilant and aware to what they're saying, what words they're using, how they're using them, picking up phrases that they kind of casually tossed off, and they didn't think anything of it, but that phrase meant something. Or the biggest thing is, they said something 7 minutes ago, and now they're saying something either related or contradictory to it, and you got to remember that. So that's what makes counseling a, well, sometimes cognitively exhausting situation. When I worked at the mental health center, we had 2 12-hour days back to back. Went into 9, and you stayed till 9. And I would do that on a Tuesday and a Wednesday. I got to tell you, if everybody showed up, by the time you got to that second day, you were fuzzed, fried, burnt. I don't care what words you want to use. Because the idea is that you can listen incredibly attentively, and the human condition can't do that for all that time and listen that hard. So on the E-persons here, if they're not all that long, I can read them attentively. This one comes from Virginia. In the last 2 years, I have lost 7 souls who went to the Lord. One of these souls was my husband of 62 years. Okay, let's do a little math here. They were married 62 years. Let's say they got married young, 20. Now, that would make Virginia 82. Which means when you live to be 82, your life is going to have an awful lot of souls leave it. Sort of the way it is. I had a relative in our family. She lost all 3 of her sons. She lived to be 90-something, and her sons died in their 60s and 70s. And she said, it's not right. This is not the way it should be, that you should watch your children be buried. And I remember my grandmother at age 96, when my dad died at age 76, she outlived them. When you live long enough, you don't go to weddings anymore, you go to funerals. So that is the nature of it. So, she said, it was very difficult to lose my husband. He was a good man and father to our children. He died of dementia, a terrible disease. Well, that's true. There are many kinds of dementia. The most common is Alzheimer's. But there are many kinds. There's 50-some kinds. He had gone blind for 25 years. Had heart problems and about 9 bypasses. Well, here's a guy who was in fragile health, struggling health. The only way I made it, now this is interesting because she gives credit to her mother. Unlike many of the young adults nowadays who not only don't give credit to their parents, but they blame their parents. Now here's a woman probably in her 80s giving credit to her mother. The only way I made it was because my mother gave me and my siblings spirituality. Now, she frames it that way. She doesn't mean her mother actually, to be theologically correct, gave her spirituality and the faith. Obviously not. But I think she's saying that she taught us this. And then she went on to say that. She talked about God. We saw her pray. She taught us perseverance, steadfastness. No matter what happens. Our home life, now this is interesting. She says, our home life was not the best because my father was not a family man. Mm. So mom was the spiritual influence. So you see, what my mother gave us was a life skill. Yeah, it was more than that, Virginia. It was a way of looking at the world. And if God is God, then he knows the absolute best way to look at yourself and the world. It's that simple. It's logical. It makes no sense to not do it God's way as he has taught us through the scripture and his church. It makes no sense. If he's God, he's God. He's infinitely bright. It's been tough these last few years, losing loved ones. But I find myself more and more thanking my mother for the best gift a parent can give to her children. When I think of her, I say, thank you, Mom. Virginia, I'm hoping she can hear you. But isn't it interesting what Virginia is talking about here? Which is, as life has gotten tougher, and it does do that. When you get older, you lose the skills. You lose an awful lot of the stuff that made you more smoothly negotiate life, at least physically or in relationships. Now, you don't necessarily lose how you look at things and you mature, or perhaps you, as Father Benedict Rochelle says, you have a gift of becoming closer to the Lord as you get older. But what she found was, as I navigate these years of my life, I realize what my mom gave me. How much do we not realize it when we're 23? My age, I look back at Mom and Pop, and I'm more grateful for the way Mom and Pop were. They were just decent souls who lived their lives, low profile. My dad was just a good guy. He just went to work, supported his family. Nothing about Pop stood out in the world's eyes. He was just an average Joe. But not to me. Even with what... Now, here's the crux of it. I probably didn't save enough time for this for the break. Even with what my mother gave me, I have questions about God. Boy, I wish I knew what those questions were. I'm a reader, and I've found God in the books I read. Well, a lot of it, Virginia, depends upon what kind of books you read. I mean, you maybe have no way of knowing some of the stuff you read and whether it's solid or not. I watch EWTN, but I also watch other religious channels. These channels keep me grounded, and I'm always learning about God. Virginia, the only thing I'd say about that is that if there is an overall teaching truth about who God is, what he has left us, who he's more or less left in authority, then you got to be careful, because some of the other religious channels that you listen to may be very confusing to you. They may say things that put down your Catholic faith, or challenge it as wrong and incorrect, or in the worst case scenario, evil. I've seen many, many people have their head get all fuzzed up. For me, once I became convinced that the Catholic Church was who Jesus meant to establish, and if you look at it historically, it's hard to argue with it, then I have to measure whatever any other faith tradition says in light of what the Catholic Church says. And to the degree that it agrees with the church, it's on a parallel path. To the degree that it criticizes or misunderstands or misrepresents the church, then it misses it. You can't simply say, well, you know, that church is right because they think this, and this church over here is right because they think this, if they contradict each other. If one church, one tradition says it's okay to kill a baby in a womb, and the other one says, no, it's not, it never is, well, one of them's going to be right. You can't say, well, they just disagree. There's the confusing aspect. So be careful about what you're watching, my dear.
Hello, friends, and welcome to another segment of The Crux of the Matter. I'm Father Wade Menezes. Today I'd like to discuss why it is wrong for a man and woman to live together before marriage. There's an old wise maxim that states, the breaking of the rules before marriage will naturally lead to the breaking of the rules after marriage. It has also been said that fornication before marriage will likely lead to adultery after marriage. But what if the couple is living chastely? What if the couple is not having premarital relations? Let's say they're living together chastely for the sake of cutting down on expenses, for the consolidating of bills, and that they're planning on getting married in the near future. Is it still a good idea for them to live together before marriage without the benefits of the marriage covenant? The answer is simply, no, it is not. And this answer makes good, logical sense. As faithful Catholics, we already know that the sin of fornication, that is, sexual relations before marriage, is displeasing to Almighty God. And if done with full knowledge and deliberate consent, it is a mortal sin. And what about all of the beautiful mystery that the marriage covenant brings with itself? If such mysteries, both the sexual and the non-sexual, are discovered before marriage, then the couple begins their covenantal union with no foundation on which to build its success. The old adage, familiarity breeds contempt, comes to mind here. Lastly, friends, why would someone take the risk of putting himself or herself in the near occasion of sin? Remember, as Catholics, we know that we're called not only to avoid sin directly, but we are also called to avoid what's called the near occasion of sin, those persons, places, or things that can lead us to sin. Living together does just that. To move in together is simply not a wise move at all. And that's the crux of the matter. God bless you, and thank you for joining us.
I did some calculating. I told Andrew Krucek, my producer man over there in Ann Arbor, this before. There's a 30-second bumper run with music when you come in from a break. Now, I think we have, let's see, how many breaks do we have, Andrew? One, two, four? We had four hard breaks or four soft breaks, whatever. We have four breaks. So 30 seconds. That's 2 minutes. Okay. Now, if I let that music run, say, to the 27-second mark, kind of like pro football. There's a 30-second play clock. And when they're trying to run out the clock at the end of the game, they don't snap that ball until they're without 1 or 2 seconds left. So if I let all this music play all the way to the end, let's say rather than jumping in at the 5-second mark, I jump in at the 25-second mark. That's 20 seconds. That is four breaks, 20 seconds. That's 80 seconds per show that I just sit there and listen to the music. 80 seconds. Average show's 52 minutes, 80 seconds. About every month and a half, I get a free show. Yeah, if you calculate it that way. Just thought about that. It was back from my early days as a sort of a math major at Case Tech. I have to tell you this. In the 1980s, well, actually, no. So I'm going to go back. No. 1970s. I fell off my bike. And I skinned my knee. I feel compelled to tell you this now because we didn't have social media then. So I just wanted you to know that, just to tell you. All right, let's go to the calls here. See what we got. We are foster parents to 3 children, 13, 8, and 7. All right, stop right there. I have off the charts respect for foster parents because they are stepping into situations that by their very definition, these children have not had stable lives. They've had abusive, neglectful, traumatic, erratic upbringings. So as a result, they're coming into the foster system very, very much lagging in socialization, self-control, conscience. Now, the foster parent system has rather strict requirements on what foster parents are allowed to do. For example, as far as I know, in most states, you cannot bring a child to church with you unless that child wants to go. All right. So, she says, the kids have had a history of neglect, physical, and emotional abuse. All right, there you have it. Somewhat historical pattern, common. The 8 and the 7-year-olds have rarely had consequences in their lives. In other words, they've just sort of been on their own, and in all likelihood, if they had consequences, they were just erratic when the parents had had enough and they did something about it. But there was not this consistent attempt in the context of love to teach these kids. That's what you got to have. You don't have that, you're going to get a kid who is way, way behind in getting along in life. We are now trying to start from scratch with discipline. True. And one of the problems here, of course, is in a foster setting, you do not have the leeway of a biological parent. You don't. There are certain constrictions that are placed upon you. Dr. Ray, I know it takes a long time and lots of consistency. But in the short term, when they won't obey the command to go to timeout, what can we do? It's true. Now, fortunately, there's good news here, but although it's not as good a news as you would have if these were your bio kids, if we physically place them there, it usually results in an escalated and unsafe situation. What she's saying is it's a very common response. They're going to fight you. They're going to fight you physically. They're going to torque. They're going to twist. And it's ugly. And typically, I tell moms, when you're trying to physically place a 7 or 8-year-old kid in the corner, on the steps, in his room, and you're trying to do it physically, you're asking for trouble. And you're asking for trouble for this reason, for this is among other reasons, but you're asking for trouble. That child can torque and twist and resist. And in many respects, once you get to that age, I'm going to say even once you get to 4 or 5 with most parents, it becomes a battle. This isn't something that is going to happen without question. It's something that is going to result in an all-out physical clash. And as the child resists, let's assume that you can even place the child on the steps or in the corner. Well, you got two things that could happen. One, they'll just leave after you're done. Or two, they will learn that, okay, in the end, you may be able to do this, but you're going to pay one heck of a price. And furthermore, I'm learning that I can resist your authority physically. These are not good lessons. So I consequently tell moms especially, don't do this. Don't do this if, in fact, you're going to physically place a child somewhere and it's going to be obvious that child can fight you. No, you're going to lose authority. You're not going to gain authority. Parents think they're going to gain authority by doing this. Well, I put him on the steps. Yeah, it took me 17 minutes to get him there, but I got him there. Yeah, but in that 17 minutes, he learned a lot. So, first thing. Obviously, spanking is off the table. That's true. You can't, foster parents cannot spank. You're not allowed. And taking away toys doesn't make much impact. Well, okay, I'm gonna disagree with you there, Mom. It does, but you're underestimating the effect of the lack of love and discipline in this 8 and 7-year-old's life. Yeah, in the short term, they're gonna look at you like, I don't care, take it. Doesn't matter to me, so what? But over time, it may. Here's the other thing about that. And I'm going to run out of time here, so I'm going to have to pick this up on the other side of the break. The other thing about that is that your goal in doing that, if you say, okay, if you don't go to timeout, here's what I'm going to take. I'm going to take your favorite Lego blocks. Got that? So given that, and you say, well, it doesn't make any difference, he still won't go to timeout next time. Yes, but you taught something. You said, if you don't cooperate, this is what I will do. Okay. Will that change his conduct? I don't know. But what you did is you taught a condition. The condition is what you want to teach. And then over time, the conduct will follow behind. I'm going to pick this up on the other side of the break because there's more to say about this. And maybe I can give Foster Mom here some direction. I'm Dr. A, and I thank you for keeping me company.
Bishop Robert Barron.
Tolkien has reached out to, you know, Nordic culture and literature and Icelandic sagas and all sorts of things. He learned a lot about the good, the true, and the beautiful from his study of pre-Christian cultures. He used narrative forms that were accessible to the culture. He adapted that to evangelical purposes. So that shows you that flexibility. It shows you a certain creativity in the evangelical art. He did not proselytize. Rather, he very delicately and indirectly and cleverly evangelized through the imagination so that someone taking in these great stories of Tolkien or his friend C.S. Lewis, they're going to say, oh yeah, I get that. I recognize that pattern. So that finally when they hear the gospel, they'll say, yeah, I understand that. I learned that from The Lord of the Rings. I learned that pattern from the Narnia stories. And that was the genius of those fellows.
The people you know and trust are on EWTN.
Catholic Connection with Teresa Tomeo.
No one sees a face of abortion, you know, in particular, because it's hidden by semantics, it's hidden by words, it's hidden by phrases, and, you know, and these grandiose claims of, oh, we're, you know, it's all about reproductive rights and the women, and women shouldn't be, you know, forced to carry a baby to term, especially if they were victims of rape or incest. So you put all of these ideas in people's heads that this is all about the good of a woman, but not looking at the people involved, the baby, and of course, you know, for example, a woman who we know from research, Dr. David Reardon has done a lot of research on this area, that women who do conceive through rape and carry the baby to term and either keep the child or place it up for adoption are much better off mentally. Mental health, they can deal with that, they can heal much more quickly because two wrongs definitely don't make a right.
Catholic Connections, Teresa Tomeo. Weekdays, 9 a.m. Eastern. On EWTN Radio.
Well, I waited my 20 seconds because I'm going to build up to a free program here, taking advantage of the 30-second bumper music run, E-Person Monday, Dr. A. To recap before the break, got an E-Person from a foster mom, three kids, 13, 18, 7, history of neglect, physical, emotional abuse. Okay, just basically, bottom line, unsocialized. And not the kids' fault. Unfortunately, if the big people don't do what they do, the big people, little people start to look really, really rough. Got it. So she says it's very tough to discipline these kids. They don't go to the corner when they're supposed to. If we try to physically take them there, they resist. And I said, you might want to not do that because, again, if you're going to do that and that kid's torquing and fighting you, it conveys a message of this is going to be a battle here and you lose authority whenever there's a battle. Then she says we take away toys and that doesn't seem to make any difference. Well, it's not gonna, because when change in behavior takes time, and keep in mind now, these kids have had, what, close to a decade of very non-existent type of parenting or nasty parenting, then you're not going to take away some toys over the course of a month or two and see noticeable results. That's not going to happen. Not likely. So there's two things. If you do that, you're teaching a lesson. You do A, I do B. You don't go to the corner. You don't go to the steps. I take your favorite toy until you do. Okay. Now, will that change their conduct? No, probably not. And the reason it doesn't is because they're dominated by their emotions and their impulses at the moment of the next misbehavior. If something's going to happen, if I'm going to refuse you or defy you or abuse a sibling or do something nasty, I'm not thinking about the fact that I'm going to go to the corner or you're going to take my stuffed animal. I'm not thinking about that. I am moved by my emotions and my impulse at that moment. So as a result, when you take that stuffed animal and you think, well, it doesn't make any difference because 8 minutes from now, he's going to do the same thing again. Yeah, because they're not necessarily related. When you place the consequence, you teach the lesson. You do A, B will happen. Will that change the behavior? That takes much longer. In one of my earlier books, You're a Better Parent Than You Think, well, it was the earliest book, actually, I just threw out a rule of thumb. I said, for every year that a behavior has been a problem, allot at least 1 month of an intervention, of a discipline, for some progress and correction. So you got this 8-year-old and 7-year-old. Let's say they just started acting up when they were 2. Now, obviously, if they had bad parenting, they probably had a bad womb life. And if they had a bad womb life, then they probably have some problems with neurological maturity. Well, let's just say age 2 is when it all started. Well, the 8-year-old, it's been 6 years. All right. So whatever you do, you might want to consider 6 months. Now, on to the crux of your question. What else can we do to help them accept our authority? Talked about this before. Now, this works very quickly with parents and their biological children. It doesn't work as quickly in your situation, but it still can work, which is you tell them you have a new house rule. And the rule is, if you don't go to the corner or the steps when I ask you, I will not fight you. I will not put you there. I will not ask you a second time. That's it. I will say one time, please go sit on the steps. Please go to the corner. Please put your head down at the dining room table. Please go sit on the couch. Please go lay on your bed. I don't care what you use as time out. Go ahead. Although I do like the corner best because it's boring. Then you tell them that whatever you ask for after that, if it's in my power, in other words, you can't deny food, you can't deny a bathroom, but whatever else, TV, computer game, stuffed animal, whatever else you are permitted to make off limits, do so. Just simply say you can't have that until you spend your time in the corner that you have. Now, here's what's going to happen, and this is why it's going to throw you for a loop, and this is probably why when I see parents, I follow up 2 weeks later, of course, because we got to adjust for what the child does. He'll throw a fit. All right, you can't simply say, well, you don't have your stuffed animal. I put it on top of the refrigerator because you didn't go to the corner. Well, he's not going to say, oh, boy, I better go to the corner then. No. No, he's going to melt down. He's going to throw a fit on you. Okay, what are you going to do? See, I basically, in a situation like yours, I would say, well, okay, throw a fit. It's not going to get you the animal back. The animal doesn't come back until you go to the corner. Now, all right, I've been at this a long time, and I'm not so naive as to think, well, that's all you have to do, and that's the formula, and everything will be fine. I recognize that he may pick up something and throw it at the wall. He may kick something over. He's going to escalate physically. That doesn't shock me, all right? Well, you have to decide what you're permitted to do. Talk to your caseworker. Am I allowed to physically restrain him when he's looking to be threatening like that? Or how can I stop him when he does this? Now, here's what I've run up against. I've had caseworkers say, you can't do that. You have to give him a stuffed animal back. You can't take his favorite juice cup from him. You got to give it to him. I don't agree with that. I think they're off, but they're in charge. So you have to see what your parameters are, what you can do. Some caseworkers would say, hey, we just want you to stabilize this kid. This kid has had no stability. He's had 5 foster homes. Whatever you have to do within reasonable limits, do it. Some will say that. Others will say, oh, no, he's had very erratic discipline. Well, the problem with that statement is he hasn't had erratic discipline. He's had no discipline. He's had harshness. He hasn't had discipline. He's had meanness. He's had threatening. He's had nastiness. He's had a parent unload on him when the parent has had enough. So really, he didn't have erratic discipline. He had nothing. So you're right. As you said earlier in the e-person, you're starting from scratch. Given that, if you're permitted to do that, you take maybe 6 or 7 of the next privileges and you say, until you sit or until you stand in the corner or until you lay on your bed and calm down, you don't have these. You don't have to be mean. You're not threatening. You're not yelling. You're not screaming. Matter of fact, you're coming across as calm as you can, because what you want to do is you want to change the perception. You want this 8-year-old and 7-year-old to look at you and think, they care about me, but they're in charge. That's key. You got to have the perception. They did not have the perception that whoever it was in their previous life was in any kind of grown-up charge. The grown-ups in their previous life were probably nastier than the kids were. So as a result, their perception of grown-ups is, you have no authority. Don't even try it. Don't even think about this. Your perception has got to be, no, I am definitely calmly in charge, and I will demonstrate that. I'm not going to scream at you. I'm not going to yell at you. I'm not going to grab you, drag you to the corner. I'm not going to do that. I don't have to do that. So that's what you want to do. You want to change that perception. I'm Dr. Ray.
Dr. Ray has more great advice coming up. Don't go anywhere. And that's a doctor's order.
Do you own popular index mutual funds or ETFs? If so, you're automatically owned shares of companies that conflict with your moral beliefs. Ave Maria Mutual Funds are managed to conform to pro-life and pro-family values. Long-term investors can invest in the no-load Ave Maria Mutual Funds. The experienced professional portfolio managers make decisions based on investment fundamentals and pro-life values. You can learn more about Ave Maria Mutual Funds today at 866-AVE-MARIA or visit AveMariaFunds.com.
Does unity in the church eliminate diversity? No, says the Catholic Catechism. From the beginning, the Catholic Church has been marked by great diversity. Diversity in God's gifts. Diversity in the multiplicity of cultures and people who are its members. There is even diversity in its particular churches who maintain their own traditions. The Catechism asserts this is not a threat to the church's unity. Sin, however, and its consequences are a constant threat to unity. The number one bond of unity is charity, which binds everything together in perfect harmony. There are also visible bonds of unity: profession of one faith, common celebration of divine worship, especially the sacraments and apostolic succession through the sacrament of holy orders. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
Okay, I've been a Catholic for 5 years, but I suffered under a lot of things due to my Protestantism as a Pentecostal, and I just want to personally ask God to bless you for your ministry, for everything you do, and the help that you give people.
EWTN, helping people grow in their love and understanding of God.
Thank you for joining me, Dr. Ray Grandy, E-Person Monday. Why do I call it person? Of course, linguistically sensitive. he male is so patriarchal. If you notice that, man, every commercial, everything you see on TV, the guys are the doofuses and the buffoons and the hypocrites and the ridiculous ones. It's like they've decided that men have been given too much privilege in all of human history, and now we've got to pack it all in 3 months and decide you guys are all jerks, and the women are stronger, faster, smarter than you in every single way possible, and a woman can throw a 97-mile-an-hour fastball if she just got the right angle on her arm. Okay. Well, this one came to me, and I think this really fits me. You don't get smarter as you get older. There's just less dumb stuff left that you haven't done already. You know, this is true. This is the old, you need experience. How do you get experience? By making mistakes. By being wrong a lot. Then you get smarter. Seems to be a circuitous way to get to it, doesn't it? Don't you think you get smarter by doing the right things? But typically, you have to get smarter by doing the wrong things. The old German axiom, wie geht too soon old and too late smart. This is true. The problem, of course, how long does it take you to learn? That's the problem. If you learn the first time, psychologists call it one trial learning. It's usually a consequence that is so significant that that's all you have to have. You will eliminate that behavior, or you will gain a behavior because you got a certain consequence, whether it was a reward or a punishment, and you learn from it. Unfortunately, fallen human nature says we got to be repeatedly taught. Think about it. In your life, how much are you still struggling with the same stuff you used to struggle with 20 years ago? The same people still bug you. The same remarks still set you off. The same immature, dumb, opening your mouth when you shouldn't open your mouth moves, you still do. And if you want any proof of that, ponder what you say in the confessional. Are you like me? Saying the same stuff? I want to write all my sins on a piece of paper and hand them to Father and say, you know, Father, this covers most of what I've been saying for the last several decades. Why am I not getting this? I must be more willful in a lot of ways than God's grace, because he's given me the grace to try to conquer some of this stuff. I'm still doing it. What is wrong with me? How many times am I going to have to learn? It's always fascinated me about the human condition. Think about your life. In essence, much of the source of your distress or your day-to-day frustration or irritation or anger, whether it's at your spouse, your kids, siblings, whatever, friends, is the same stuff. There's not too much new. Much of the time, it's just snotty remarks. It's thoughtless behavior. And by the way, be careful about that stuff, too, because we do that, too. You know, we're always attuned to what somebody else is doing to us. And every time somebody else does something like that to me, I got to think to myself, do I do that? If I'm so hypersensitive to what they're doing, what about me? I could be doing that. So, given all that, why is it taking me so stinking long to get this? If I got somebody in my life who says a lot of things that bother me, why does it still bother me? This is remark number 2,165 that they've said that way. Why am I still at the same level, or maybe worse, bothered by this? See, the problem is me. It's not them. I can't look at them and say, what is wrong with them? No, the problem is me. What is wrong with me? That I'm not getting the idea here. That I do not have to react with the same intensity that I reacted the first 1,000. You figure by 1,500, might start to lose some of its potency. So, yeah, I guess I find that I get smarter not so much because I've learned, but maybe because I've been taught that some of the dumb stuff that I've done doesn't work. Fortunately, well, unfortunately, it's got to be repeated. I'm Dr. Ray. Thank you so much for letting me go on that rant. I appreciate your company very much. And I thank Andrew Krucek over there in Ann Arbor who makes this show run. He's on the boards, as we say in basketball. And he does everything he has to do on that end. And I thank you for keeping me company. Appreciate it an awful lot. Walk with God. Now that's one trial learning. You make that walk, you'll learn. Takes one time.
For information on Dr. Ray's presentations, books, and CDs, visit DRA.com and follow him on Facebook. The Doctor Is In is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.